Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm James Woolcock.
Welcome to the programme on this Friday. We're returning to a subject today which has returned to, I suppose, the forefront of UK politics, and that is the Israel-Hamas war. Now, in previous weeks on this programme, we've talked a lot about how this issue has caused splits within the Labour Party and caused problems for the Labour leader, Keir Starmer. But now the debate is at the centre of Cabinet as well, as we have this effort by the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary who are trying to suspend arms sales to Tel Aviv. That's an issue, though, that's causing some debate within the Cabinet. Interesting, James, to see this become an issue now that's also very much to the forefront in the Tory party.
Yes, I mean, this is some interesting point from Bloomberg's very own Alex Wickham, who says, I mean, trying is an interesting word, Stephen, from the Foreign Secretary. They are waiting on this legal advice, but they are certainly weighing it all up as these recent sort of airstrikes that killed British aid workers have set sort of the UK press alight on the issue. And you've seen sort of things like various cartoons and etc. But up until now, Cameron has been a fascinating Foreign Secretary because this would normally be a kind of Labour Party issue. But Keir Starmer, in trying to distance himself from Jeremy Corbyn, has had his hands tied in what he can say. So in many ways, Cameron has been probably one of the most prominent critics in the UK of the Israeli regime and how it is prosecuting this war. But, as Alex Wickham says, in trying to take this issue further, Cameron himself has run into splits right at the heart of Cabinet in how you go further, to the point where earlier this week in a BBC interview, the Foreign Secretary said, I'm not going to take any questions on Gaza at all, which is quite an interesting position to take as the Foreign Secretary, the person who's supposed to sort of set out the UK's stance on this issue. It's also flipped the dynamic where, if you go back to October last year, you would see Conservative MPs, any kind of Conservative politico, going on the media and saying to Labour, tell us out your stance, set us out what you're doing, trying to kind of probe that political weakness. It's a very, it's very cynical politics playing. Now we see Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy going to the government saying, publish your legal advice, show us what you're looking at, and is that way putting pressure back on the Conservatives. It's been a complete role reversal.
Yeah, it has, and it's something too that others are also watching very closely, how the UK government is conducting itself. Over 800 lawyers and academics, including three former Supreme Court judges, have signed a letter to the Prime Minister warning Britain's in breach of international law by continuing to supply arms to Israel. They say that Britain's international obligations require it to suspend the provision of weapons and weapon systems to the government of Israel. Well, joining us now to discuss is one of the signatories of that letter, the human rights lawyer and King's Counsel, Michael Mansfield. Michael, welcome to the programme. Can you explain to us what the basis of this call is that you're making for the government?
I do want to make one thing clear from the beginning, that the letter, although it has been has attracted a certain amount of publicity, it concentrated on the question of supply of weapons and the licenses being issued by government, which of course is an important issue, but actually the letter isn't only about that. There was a letter sent by the same, well, actually many more have joined, originally about 600 lawyers, then it's risen to over 1,000 lawyers now. First letter went back in October, indicating that we were concerned about the possibility of human rights, international human rights breaches being committed actually by both sides, not just, by Hamas as well as by the Israelis, because even then Israel was indicating that they might do, they were a ground offensive, which we felt was going to inevitably breach in international humanitarian law, however you look at it. But however, we've been proved right, because since then, The International Court of Justice on two occasions, once quite recently, the other in January, have, as you may know, issued provisional measures for, obviously, towards the protection of civilians' non-combatants in armed conflict, which international law provides for. And therefore, this letter is written on the back of all that. The UN rapporteur thought the threshold had been crossed for violations earlier in the year. So it isn't just about the provision of weapons, because the other aspect of the letter is, well, there were lots of aspects, but the other major is saying to government, this UK government, as well as other governments, you have an obligation under international law to protect, and obviously UK citizens getting killed is another example of that, to protect non-combatants and aid workers. Therefore, if that's not happening, you've got to reconsider your whole relationship with this country.
So and at is the moment, they're on. Michael, just to help us understand, this, is it the death of those three British aid workers that, I suppose, increases the legal burden on the government to take action now, as opposed to, as you say, the calls that were made many months ago to largely the same end?
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose in practice it probably does. It shouldn't increase it, because the need and the urgency was there to protect non-combatants and aid workers from whatever country working for UNRWA and all the rest of it. And I know the controversy that's arisen, but we haven't had any proof. And we're suggesting in the same letter that UNRWA, the United Nations organization that provides aid in Gaza and has done for years, should be continued. So this is a broad letter across, you know, the front of saying you must stop arming, stop being an accessory to the potential plausible war crimes that are being committed. Because obviously, if you support that nation, you are an accessory. If what you do in supporting provides them, as it were, with encouragement to continue doing what they're doing. So the 2030 roadmap for UK-Israeli bilateral relations, we think, has to be suspended until Israel, and Hamas, obviously, Israel respects international law, which it never does. When the International Court of Justice came out with a ruling in 2004 about the building and erection of a separation wall and were told to take it down, they took no notice. And that is the problem.
You know this, but for the benefit of our listeners as well, of course, the Israeli government's argument is that Hamas doesn't respect international law either. And there are those who are also involved in this debate in British politics who point to the fact that Israel is waging a war against a terrorist organisation, as Hamas has been designated by the United Kingdom, and needs the UK's support. How would you respond to that?
No, I think the international law does not recognise, oh, well, I can commit an unlawful act because Hamas are doing it as well. No, that's not part of the argument, and it shouldn't ever be. Of course, it's part of the political argument, I understand that, but it's not part of the legal argument. Hamas should be as accountable as the Israeli government. Of course, we recognize that. My problem actually is that neither side, as you just said, are actually respecting this. Now, this is outside the bounds of this letter, and I can't say I'm speaking on behalf of any of the other signatories, of which there are a large number. But it seems to me that the regime, international regime, agreed at the end of the Second World War was that everybody, a consensus at that time was, we do not wish to go through this again. I was born during the Blitz, and that's what Gaza's suffering now is, a Blitz. And the idea
I want to take us back to the debate that's happening here in the UK, though, because I'm conscious that
The debate here. It's important to know the history. We're not talking about what happened yesterday. We're talking about what happened at the end of the Second World War. A regime was set up to prevent this. Part of that regime was a UN resolution. Now, a UN Security Council resolution on this case has been passed a few days ago, that there should be a ceasefire. Now, what's going to happen? Nothing.
And what's the consequence for the British government here if they don't do what you're calling for?
They become accessories, and they're liable. You know, it may seem dramatic, but they're liable to end up in the we haven't talked about the ICC, but the International Criminal Court. And the whole point I want to get to, it's really important, and nobody discusses it because you only want to talk about what happened yesterday. The fact is that after the Second World War, the regime was, you are only allowed to take this kind of action. In other words, defend yourself, proportionately and for a limited period, and the UN would then send in a peacekeeping force. Now, that's what I'm saying at the moment. If we should be thinking about considering sending in a UN peacekeeping force to protect aid workers and so on. That's why it's relevant now. This was provided for. Problem, America, Russia, and to some extent the United Kingdom, that usually sits on the fence, have blocked these measures, and so they're sitting there unused. And I'm angry about this, as you can tell, because, you know, I've worked the whole of my life in to ensure that the rule of law is the thing that governs this, not, you know, jungle warfare, if you like, or whatever you call it.
Michael, you can hear the passion, and you take us through kind of the formation of this international system, but we've been covering sort of the issue around international law and the UK's relationship with it for a few years now. If you look at things like Rwanda or Brexit, and it's hard to get away from. If you talk to some modern politicians today, they say that we shouldn't be bound by international law in all sorts of other ways. Yet, so when you come on and say we need to be acting now because we are liable under international law, part of me wants to ask you, but in many ways, politicians in the UK don't want to be bound by international law. What would you say to them?
Yes, it's interesting. The people who don't want to be bound, they're the ones who want to take, you know, unilateral action. They're the ones who actually are not having regard to the fact that, you know, we're in a global situation now. We really are, more than we were at the end of the Second World War, because of connections through electronic and so on, that you've got instant connections with all parts of the world. And we are one race. We're a human race. We have responsibilities to others. The same people will be very reluctant to send aid. The same people will be very reluctant to do anything if it's outside their borders. Well, sorry, I don't agree. They'll be the same people who don't want asylum seekers, the same people who don't want small boats. Sorry, I'm not going to, as it were, be cajoled by that group of people who are saying, well, international law. Have the United Nations and all of us been wasting our time? In other words, why don't we just withdraw from all these treaties?
You make a very good argument, but why is it, do you think, these politicians aren't listening? Why is this a debate and not as clear-cut as you've laid out?
Well, it's a good question that you pose. Why have we got to that state? I think we've got to that state because there has been a dereliction of obligation. Now, you'll probably say, oh, Michael, this is outside the scope. My concern at the moment is that politics have become degraded, denuded. We're not living in a particularly democratic situation any longer.
Could taking the actions that you're suggesting, could that actually help to restore that?
Yes, because actually what I think is going to happen in the next election is that people have had enough of the lies, the deception, the corruption. It's not just in the UK. It's happening, you know, throughout the world in all sorts of different arenas. People on the street have had enough. They've had enough that they're not listening to. And I think
Does Labour have a better approach to this? Do you think that they would go further in government to take these actions?
I don't think they've got a better result at all. At the very beginning of this whole business, Keir Starmer and Emily Thornberry, both of them lawyers, were actually saying Israel had the right for effectively collective punishment. They didn't use that word, but what they meant was they were supporting Israel cutting off the water and food at that point. And since that time, they've been very slow to call for a ceasefire. They wait for the Tories and then see what they move. So I'm sorry, I've lost faith in Labour leadership as well, but I haven't lost faith in the people.
And the Labour Party, of course, would the leadership would characterise their comments in a different way, as we've heard on many occasions and reported extensively on this programme as well. But I appreciate that's your view of how you feel they've spoken on this as well. I'm still focused on the idea of solutions, though. We know this legal advice is going back and forth between the cabinet and the government as well. You know, is this a sort of thing, given the your experience and knowing how the legal advice transmits to the government as well, is the sort of thing that you could see an Attorney General recommending that the UK has to do this in line with your point of view to respect international law?
Yes. And what is, if you will recall, you probably do, over the Iraq war, there was a similar problem with the Goldsmith Attorney General, as he was then, advice that he'd given. Everybody wanted to know what it was. And in fact, in the end, it was published. And in fact, it wasn't particularly supportive of Tony Blair at that time. Now, I don't know what the terms of this advice are, but I think it should be published. It's in the public interest for us to know what legal advice. And Cameron himself said, when he first took a position as the foreign minister, I don't appear to have had a legal advice or something to this effect across my desk. That's a very good question, Lord Cameron. Yeah, my feeling is there will have been some advice. Of course they've taken advice because they're actually in the middle of a situation where they issue, as I've already said, licenses. And they have to make sure that when they're licensing somebody to export weapons, wherever it is in the world, they have to be as sure as it can humanly be possible that they're not running the risk that what they're allowing to be exported will be used for offensive and non-human rights issues. So
this
it's
is a
very important...
As an amateur, Michael, I'm just curious, as a non-lawyer, how long does this legal advice that we are all in sort of a holding pattern waiting for take to update, to get written? Like, how long should I, as a journalist, theoretically be sort of like, oh, giving them free license, say, oh, well, clearly it's not ready yet, it hasn't been updated yet, when we next, say, talk to a politician who might read it?
Oh, I think they shouldn't be given any time at all. This is a moving feast. Feast is perhaps the wrong word. It's a moving disaster. What has happened here is that every day you read something else. So actually, what was written whenever it was, which is presumably months ago, needs to be updated regularly. And in fact, Cabinet needs to know on a daily basis, particularly as, and this is where the aid workers is particularly relevant, where, you know, that Israel has been asked for explanations of things like this. And I've done some of the cases that arise out of the Middle East where British citizens are being killed. Mr. Herndl is one of them, comes to mind, you may remember. And they always claim that they will do an investigation. And they always claim, first of all, they deny it happened. Then they do an investigation. In the Herndl case, somebody was prosecuted in the end. However, it's very rare indeed for anyone to be held accountable. And in the context of what's happened since October last year, there have been several requests to Israel. There were Médecins Sans Frontières lost aid workers. 200 aid workers have been killed already by mistake. I mean, you've got to get a reality here. Oh, sorry. Yeah, it wasn't intentional, but, you know, it was a mistake. It was a deliberate, you know, focusing drone attack or whatever it was. But we didn't. It was a mistake. Well, what kind of mistake is...
I'm just wondering how much legal weight can be attached to the International Court of Justice preliminary or provisional orders that you mentioned as well. You know, how can those be actioned in any way in the UK to influence the government's decisions?
Well, yes, another good question, of course. I quite agree. And one of the objects of all of our efforts since the Second World War, although I obviously was only born then, but efforts has been, first of all, erect the structure. Well, that's happened. Second, put in place the laws that relate to those international structures. Third, most difficult bit, enforce them. Now, what the International Court of Justice has done, this is not an advisory opinion. This is a judgment which is binding, legally binding. And the UN Special Security Council resolution is binding. Now, the problem is Israel will ignore a lot of it. So how do you, and so will Hamas, put it in the same breath. The warring parties, if you like, will ignore all of that. Then your question is, how does this impact the British government? It certainly should, if the British government is concerned about the rule of law, and this is why I say politics is in disarray. Mm. After Boris Johnson decided to turn his back on the Brexit issue, on proroguing Parliament and all the rest of it, and what happened during COVID, responsibility of politicians under the rule of law domestically and internationally has faded away. It shouldn't have. And I'm hoping that there are one or two politicians still left who've got a political and legal conscience and will say to themselves, when the International Court says this, overwhelmingly of the judges that sat, who only two voted against, 23 in favour. So it's a major decision by international judiciary, never mind the letter we've written. It's about time some British politicians, and actually Irish as well, you know, Northern and South, and Scotland and Wales, all of these politicians stand forward and say, we are going to respect the law. If we don't have respect for the law, it's all over for all of us. We might as well go back into our holes and just wait for the bombs to drop. So,
we touched on this point a couple times, Michael, in terms of you sort of say the Conservative government have lost respect for sort of international law and, you know, it would be a mistake to say they're bound by it, etc. But I would put it to you that some Conservative MPs would paint you as the enemy of all things good, a lefty North London lawyer, the kind of things they throw at Keir Starmer, trying to tell the rest of the country how to behave and how to act. And yet they would say, like, distanced from the reality of the economy, of geopolitics, of migration. I admit it's a caricature, one that is used, say, to target, say, the Labour leader Keir Starmer, but what would you respond to when they point to things like Brexit and say, well, you don't understand what it's like to be a real normal person living in society?
I think I'm the one living in society. They're not. They're out of touch. And actually, the answer to your question, I've had all this before, right from the beginning, you know, being targeted as somebody who's, you know, sort of left-wing, whatever. I've had all this. You know, it's nonsense. I'm part of 1,000 lawyers. Are you going to say the ex, you know, judges that are on this particular letter, Brenda Hale in particular, was head of the Supreme Court, they can't be tar-brushed in this way? What I'm saying is that what's in this letter, principally, it's saying to the world of politics, we're absolutely exhausted trying to get you to look at what has been worked at by lawyers and politicians, not people like me, you know. So it's not, if you want to tar brush me with that, you can if you want, but I'm backed up by, you know, 900 and other lawyers, none of them who can be characterized, maybe some of them can, I don't know, but it's a nonsense. I don't care what the right wing of the Labour Party or the right wing of the Tory Party say politically about me, that I have rights. I've worked solidly at this particular task, and no one can claim that I haven't had human rights, human dignity, and human respect at the centre of all my work. Have they? I doubt it.
Well, Michael, I want to ask you from that point of view then, do you have any hope that this letter might actually yield action?
Yes, I do have hope. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting
here
doing it.
Who are you directing your hope at?
I'm hoping that this letter addressed to Rishi, I realise he doesn't necessarily get to see all the letters that get written. I think on this one, he will have seen it not because of my name, but because of all the, you know, very high ranking lawyers plus judges who signed this one. I think it will have come to his attention, or it will have been drawn to his attention and to the minister and to Lord Cameron. And there are still, you know, there's still minds and consciences, whatever party they're in, who actually do recognize what I'm talking about. And I hope that there is still a little bit of conscience left, because without it, you know, there is no hope. But I do believe the conscience is there, and we've got to tap into it and be actually persistent. Make sure the message is got over, not just today, but tomorrow and the day after until it, you know, the penny drops. Well, whatever coin you want to use.
And do voters need to bear that in mind then? We're in an election year. Do they need to be voting with their conscience as well?
Yes.
Well, now, who would you say they vote for, out of curiosity?
Well, I get this question asked all the time, and I think in the context of this, I'm allowed to say it. I've got a book out called Power of the People, Not the People in Power, in which I talk about this very issue. I'm saying in the meetings I have, and I've been to innumerable over the last 6 months, the feeling... Of course, it's anecdotal. Of course, I'm only addressing a few hundred each time. The feeling I've had is unanimous. Everybody's had enough of the system and what it produces. They're wanting change. I can name you the organizations that are going for it, like Compass and so on. A totally different system. And people are saying, we have no faith. So what they're going to do, I think this could be a very interesting election where people don't necessarily vote for the obvious candidate. And it's the last opportunity, in my view, and probably in my lifetime, given my age, in which we can put democracy back into place and responsibility and accountability back into place. That's the reason for these public inquiries. It's because, I mean, look at the post office. They're people who didn't obviously respect the rule of law, did they? And that's something that's now being examined. Now, I don't want to get distracted on that, but this is an absolutely fundamental point. That most of the people I represent, they say they want accountability. Well, they want the truth. They want accountability. Those two things run together. They're handmaidens.
Okay, Michael, I feel like we could probably talk to you for hours about where you feel like democracy should go from here, but it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us. That's the human rights lawyer, King's Counsel Michael Mansfield there. One of the signatories, more than 800 now of lawyers and academics who've signed that letter to the Prime Minister warning that Britain is in breach of international law, calling for 5 actions, including suspending arms sales to Israel and for a review of the trade agreement as well. James, this issue, it feels like we talked about it at the start of the programme, was something that we were monitoring very closely about the divisions in the Labour Party. This is now going to the heart of government.
It's fascinating, though, because at the core of it, Michael did have hope that at the heart of the government, people have consciences and will listen in that faith of people, but yet was, I think it's fair to say, furious at the idea of people like Boris Johnson who denied the idea of international law. But there was some redemption there, although I don't feel like I had any clear idea of who he would vote for at the end, despite his answer on it.
No, we'll have to find time to talk to him about that in the future. A very interesting conversation to wrap up the week, focusing on one of the big political discussion issues in the country. That is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Sean Glastamachia. I'm James Wilcock.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more on Monday. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.